And now, from approximately coast to coast, it's the Bob and Ray Public Radio Program. Thank you very much. It is just that.
Yeah, it's the Bob and Ray Public Radio Program.
I'm Bob.
And look, I'll be Ray then, huh?
All right, okay. And we're anxious to let you know about the new series of programs we've done that this station will be proudly airing real soon.
Now, we have many new features, some of the old, and, of course, our Bob and Ray family, Webley Webster, Wally Ballou, Mary McGoon.
Why don't we introduce some of them right now? Webb, you're standing by the closest. Webley Webster.
How do you do? It's a pleasure to be here, I'm sure.
You can save your applause until they've all come forward here. Mary McGoon.
Yes.
Wally Ballou.
Yes.
Hello, everybody.
Well, it's really going to be wonderful.
And it's going to be beamed by a satellite, I'm told. What does that, that mean?
I don't know how it's going to get here, Webb, but it will somehow. And here's more great news.
Ah, yes, there's good news today, friends.
Good news for you folks, but bad news for us.
We've done it again, and our loss is your gain.
See, in anticipation of the Easter season, we laid in a large supply of chocolate rabbits.
Now, they were the best chocolate rabbits money could buy. Each one was genuine chocolate, all chocolate.
Each one had a purple ribbon tied around his or her neck.
Each one was edible, real edible.
But through the carelessness of one of our alert uniformed attendants, these chocolate rabbits were stored next to the steam pipes in our overstocked surplus warehouse.
So we now are able to offer at a ridiculously low price exactly 20 gross of genuine, laughably edible, all chocolate wobblies.
Now these wobblies are not only appropriate for any season, but the kiddies will have great fun trying to guess what the wobblies are supposed to represent.
Now, some of you youngsters will recognize dinosaurs, wombats, and anteaters.
Others will see pterodactyls, vultures, and their mother-in-laws.
But friends, this is backed up by the Bob and Ray unconditional guarantee. Not one of the kiddies will know these were once rabbits.
Any wobbly mistaken for a wabbit can be returned to the Bob and Ray Overstock Surplus Warehouse, where the full purchase price will be laughingly returned.
And never again do we expect to be able to make this amazing offer.
The warehouse engineers have already removed the steam pipes, and with them our alert uniformed attendant.
So be the first in your neighborhood now to surprise your kiddies. And remember, each of these edible all-chocolate wobblies has somewhere in it a real purple ribbon.
Now that makes for an extra surprise that'll really give the little nippers a bang. Also pull out any loose teeth they may have been trying to dislodge.
So write immediately now to Windfall, New York, New York.
And say, we'll bite. We have with us today our Bob and Ray financial advisor, Dr. Rex Latchford, to answer your questions about investment. Doctor, I'm afraid we can only allow a few minutes for this feature because we didn't know you were planning to come by today.
Well, that's a direct result of my latest money-saving idea. I didn't call ahead because I had the phone taken out of my office. I expect to save at least $25 a month that way.
Well, I guess that'll add up over the years if you can operate your office without a phone. But isn't it true, you told us last time that you use the title doctor because you're a veterinarian?
That's right. However, I don't need a phone because my business is all mail order, see? I sell good luck charms that light up in the dark and other novelties like that.
Seems like an unusual sideline for a veterinarian.
Well, I'm not exactly a practicing veterinarian. I dropped out of school a few semesters before I got my degree, see?
Well, how can you use the title doctor at all, then?
Well, I don't know. Just get started some way, and people pick it up.
I mean, kind of like a nickname,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah, that's it. Doc, you know.
Doc.
Yeah, like a nickname. Yeah.
Well, we're glad you're here, even though we weren't expecting you, and I can see our phones are lighting up already with calls from listeners seeking your advice on how to invest their life savings, so why don't you just take over?
Well, fine. I always enjoy talking to people who have extra money they don't know what to do with. Hello. You're on the air with Dr. Rex Latchford.
Hello. I've recently made a large profit selling tickets in the California State Lottery, and I'm looking for some place to invest it.
All right. Incidentally, I didn't know that California had a legalized state lottery now.
It doesn't. That's how I've been able to make such a large profit selling tickets in it.
I see. Well, now that I've had the opportunity to learn more about your business and its objectives, I think you might make a good client for my underwater salvage program. It's an ideal tax shelter.
Maybe. How does it work?
Well, you send me a check for $5,000. And if you don't hear from me again, the loss is tax deductible.
Oh, I don't mean that part. I figured that's how it worked. I mean, how does underwater salvage work? I don't want to get caught in some fly-by-night deal, you know.
Oh, this procedure is well established. A diver will be sent down into the waters off the Florida coast to recover gold from a sunken Spanish galleon. We know it's there.
You mean a guy wearing a diving outfit will do this?
Well, the investment prospectus doesn't mention what he plans to wear, but this is a multi-million-dollar project, so I'm sure they won't just buy him a ready-made suit off the rack.
Okay, I want to make sure this is all going to be done first class. I'll get my check in the mail to you tonight.
Fine. Now we'll move along to our next caller. You're on the air with Dr. Rex Latchford.
Hi, I'm Big Ed Furnose of Appleton, Wisconsin. I recently retired from my job at the overall factory up in Oshkosh.
So now you're seeking a way to invest your savings for maximum income, is that it?
No, I lost all my savings several years ago when the Sheboygan and Milwaukee Outskirts Railroad went bankrupt, so I haven't got a dime. That's my problem.
Well, I think you've diagnosed it right. That's definitely your problem, so we'll move on now for one final quick call. Hello, you're on the air with Dr. Rex Latchford.
Hello, I'm calling long distance from Laramie, Wyoming.
Well, I'm sorry, but it's the other Rex Latchford who used to live in Laramie.
Gee, you sure came back with that remark awful fast.
Well, I just wanted to make that point clear.
I guess you've gotten calls like this before since the other Rex Latchford also worked that scam about hunting for Spanish gold.
No, this is the first I've ever heard of anything like that. However, we seem to be running out of time
here. I think I'll
start
the paperwork to have you extradited to Wyoming just in case you turn out to be the same guy.
Well, suit yourself. And now, friends, until my next broadcast, which may come to you from either Costa Rica or Brazil, this is Dr. Rex Latchford wishing you all good day and good investing. Now, here's an important message for you budget-minded housewives from the makers of Einbinder Flypaper. Ladies, did you realize that the average fly who spends his whole lifetime in your home will eat a total of 4.5 cents worth of food? It's true. And we're not including stale items that you've already thrown in the trash, either. Now, it's the 4.5 cents worth of good, nourishing food that you would otherwise serve to members of your own family.
And it's gone forever once you let your home become a permanent residence for even one fly. So you'd better think about it, ladies. Doesn't it make more sense to invest in fly paper than to invest in extra food for the insects that live with you? We think it does, but to get the greatest return from your fly paper investment, don't settle for anything less than genuine Einbinder, the brand you've gradually grown to trust over the course of three generations. Welcome again to Garish Summit and its endless story of intrigue among the socially prominent. There in stately splendor, far removed from the squalid village below, they fight their petty battles over power and money.
And as we look in, tension is mounted over the presumed kidnapping of spineless young Rodney Murchfield. Amid it all, a black car with black sidewall tires pulls up in front of the Murchfield mansion. And the family's personal accountant, Bryce Waternoose, steps out. Bryce enters the house and speaks.
You, anybody home?
Up here in the solarium, Bryce. Just take the elevator to the mezzanine level and then hang a left through the music room.
Very well, I'm leaving here right away.
You are, Bryce. I'm sorry the butler wasn't available to show you in, but he's at the bank withdrawing $10 million to pay Rodney's kidnap ransom.
I hope you're not saying that you sent your butler to the bank alone to withdraw that much money in cash, Miss Agatha.
Well, what else could I do? The kidnappers insisted on $10 million in small bills, and I knew that was bound to involve some heavy lifting, so... It was clearly a job for the servants.
Well, speaking as your accountant...
Well, I'm glad that's the way you're going to be speaking, Bryce, because it's exactly what I called you here to do. Am I correct in assuming that the ransom I pay to get Rodney back will be fully tax-deductible?
Well, not necessarily, Miss Agatha. You see, it's considered an illegal payment, even if the crooks are willing to give you an itemized receipt.
I was afraid of that. So I've come up with a plan that should win a more favorable ruling from the IRS. Suppose I take the $10 million and I donate it to our local university to set up a Rodney Murchfield scholarship fund. I think my son would like that.
Well, I'm not sure he'd like it under these circumstances. I just wonder what his kidnappers will say when they find out you're dodging taxes by giving the ransom money to a university instead of to them.
Hey, I just heard some news on the radio that upset me a whole lot, Rodney.
Oh? What is it, Lefty? Another stalemate in the Mideast?
No. It's a little more personal. It explains why the ransom payment for you never came. Your mother's using it to set up a Rodney Murchfield Memorial Scholarship.
A Memorial Scholarship? But that would indicate I'm no longer living.
Oh. Did I say Memorial? Just a slip of the tongue. I guess I was picturing what the police will assume I plan to do with you now.
Chief, what do you assume the kidnappers plan to do with Rodney Murchfield now that they know the ransom won't be paid?
Well, I understand the criminal mind completely, Sergeant. They won't keep a victim around who's just another mouth to feed. So my deduction from that premise is that they'll turn Rodney loose before dinner time.
Gee, I am surprised you think so, Chief. After all, Rodney could identify the kidnappers. He might even find their pictures right here in one of our mug books, if he got the chance.
You're right, I hadn't thought of that. Suddenly it all fits together. Sergeant, go out and arrest my little boy Alfred.
But Chief, what could an 8-year-old kid have to do with the Murchfield kidnapping?
I'm not sure, but Alfred coaxed me into giving him our file of mugshots to swap for baseball trading cards. So his plan must have been to destroy vital evidence. And I intend to find out who he's protecting.
Well, will the police chief's little boy be sent away for masterminding the kidnap plot of the century? Could the butler's failure to return from the bank mean that he's masterminded the theft of the century? And what about Agatha's mysterious elevator that only runs as far as the mezzanine? Perhaps we'll learn more next time when we hear the tax auditor say...
Oh, you should have paid the ransom, lady. At least I could have allowed you 9 cents a mile for driving your own car out there to deliver it.
That's next week when we resume our endless story of intrigue on Garish Summit. We've been checking out our competition up and down the radio dial this week to see what we might do to add a few more listeners to our vast audience, and we think we've come up with just the thing.
Now, that's right. We found that a lot of other radio shows give prizes to listeners who can identify a mystery tune that's played on the air, and we thought a contest like that might be good for us, too.
Of course, this comes as wonderful news to those of you at home, because Ray and I have each chipped in $5 to be awarded to our first mystery tune winner.
But listen, that's only the beginning, friends. Our chief studio usher, Herbie, has donated his 1958 Studebaker as a major prize. And today's contest winner can claim it simply by having it shipped from the repair garage in Springfield, Ohio, where it's now scattered around the floor.
Well, all told, our contest jackpot is worth almost $100. So listen carefully and see if you can be the first to call our special Bob and Ray Mystery Tune phone number with the correct title of this song.
Okay, that's it. And now we're standing by our special phone to see if we have a lucky winner. Well, I guess not. Maybe next time.
Wait a minute, Ray. I think we have a contestant. Hello?
I have a person-to-person call for the Bob and Ray Mystery Tune phone number. Is he there, please?
Well, that's not one particular person, but I could take the call, operator.
He probably doesn't seem to be there, sir. Will you speak with anyone else?
Yeah, anybody's okay. The name of that song is...
Just a moment, sir. You'll have to deposit $1.30 for the first 3 minutes.
Oh, okay.
What's going on?
I don't know. He seems to be calling from a payphone.
That was only $1.20, sir. You have to deposit another 10 cents.
Well, gee, I don't have any more change. Could I mail it to you?
Certainly not. Don't talk nonsense.
Operator, we're on the air here. Can't we just accept the charge and get on with this?
Well, you just keep quiet. This doesn't concern you at all.
Just a minute. I found another dime, operator. Here you are.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Hello? Operator, we've been disconnected, I'm afraid.
No, you haven't. I can hear him fine.
Well, what's he saying?
He's saying he's been disconnected. Apparently, you're not talking loud enough for him to hear you.
No, I don't think that's the problem. I can't hear him either.
Well, for pity's sake, I don't know what the two of you are doing.
Hello?
Just a minute, operator. I can hear him now. Hello, sir. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, he says he can hear you fine.
Well, now I can't hear him again. Just ask him to name our mystery tune and then tell me what he says, okay?
Oh, very well, but there should be an extra charge for this service. He wants you to name some tune or other for him. Hang on. Hello, New York?
Yes?
He says it's been so long since he heard it that he forgets how it goes. Could you hum it for him?
No, and he wouldn't be able to hear me even if I did. Just cancel the call, operator.
Well, you can't cancel the call, Buster. He paid for it.
Well, that's between the two of you to work out. And we'll be carrying our treasure chest of prizes over until next time, and we'll add a big $5 to it. Try and be with us, and we'll try to find a winner in our Bob and Ray Mystery Tune Contest.
We have a word to you ladies now from our subscriber that we mentioned before, the Monongahela Metal Foundry. Ladies, we don't expect you to take our word that Monongahela steel ingots are brighter and shinier than old-fashioned brands. You can make a simple comparison test for yourself. Just drag one of your present ingots out in the yard on a sunny day and place it next to one of ours. If the Monongahela ingot doesn't shine more brightly, even without long hours of polishing, your money will be cheerfully refunded.
Oh, and remember, too, ladies, you know how ashamed you feel serving dinner guests when there are dull, corroded steel ingots piled up on the table? Well, that's why the folks at Monongahela have introduced new extra shiny ingots for home and office use. You'll be proud to display them along with your finest china and silverware. So you ask about them at your local Monongahela Foundry sales room today.
And now, Dining Out with Bob and Ray, the informative feature that helps guide you to some of the lesser-known but truly outstanding gourmet restaurants around New York and around the world. Well, Bob, I believe your adventure in dining this week took you to one of those quaint little sidewalk cafes up in the Central Park area.
Yes, it did, Ray. I'd heard a great deal about the specialties at Bernie's Pushcart on the Green. And I finally was fortunate enough to locate it the other day as it was moving north near 85th Street.
Well, I assume then from what you're saying that Bernie's Pushcart on the Green doesn't stay in one location the way most restaurants do.
No, I think it's unique among gourmet restaurants in that one respect. Bernie, my dining host, told me that he ranges from Central Park South clear up to the mid-80s, but his regular clientele is familiar with his route, so they plan their lunch hours for times when they know he'll be in the neighborhood.
Well, moving around as he does, I don't imagine that Bernie's able to provide too much in the way of atmosphere or that impeccable table service that we associate with many of the finer restaurants.
No, as the name implies, Bernie's Pushcart on the Green is just a pushcart on the green, but I would say that the wide range of offerings from the menu more than makes up for the lack of atmosphere and service. I had the number two combination. That's a hot dog with pickle relish. Bernie also offers his famous hot dog with mustard, hot dog with ketchup, or hot dog Chateaubriand. That's served for two with sauerkraut.
Well, I suppose you can also get a plain hot dog with nothing on it if you prefer.
No, I don't think you can. But with all the succulent relishes offered by Bernie, I don't imagine the absence of a plain hot dog from the menu will bother anybody. Only word of caution I might offer is that it's still a little too early in the season to enjoy an evening dinner at Bernie's. It gets chilly in the park after the sun goes down. Of course, all the muggers and the weirdos come out after dark and don't really want to be there.
From the way you've described Bernie's pushcart on the green, I think that luncheon would be the best meal to enjoy there, at least until we're well into spring.
Well, I'm sure dinner time is the high spot of the day at the restaurant you visited this week, and I think our friends listening are anxious to hear about your adventure in dining, Ray.
Well, for our dining out feature this week, Bob, I decided to drop in on a unique foreign food restaurant over in Jersey City. It's called the Little Bit of Honduras Bar and Grill.
I know how you love to sample ethnic specialties. Had you ever visited a Honduran restaurant before?
No, in fact, all I knew about Honduras was that it produces more bananas than any other country in the world, and I assumed that the people who live down there just, you know, eat bananas for every meal.
Well, I guess you must have been pleasantly surprised when you visited the Little Bit of Honduras Bar and Grill.
No, I wasn't surprised at all. The only food they serve over there is bananas, which was exactly what I'd expected.
I think it's refreshing once in a while to eat at a restaurant that only serves one thing if they serve it well.
Well, I agree. And a little bit of Honduras does serve all of its main dishes very attractively. Of course, there's no need to maintain the kitchen staff when there's nothing on the menu but bananas. So the money that would normally go to cooks and dishwashers can be spent on additional waiters.
Well, I suppose with all that help, there's prompt service, especially when it takes only a short time to prepare a banana.
That's true. What they do is they push a little tea cart up to the table that's loaded with all kinds of bananas. There's green, yellow with brown speckles, and brown starting to turn black. And then you make your own selection, and they peel it for you.
I suppose the waiters sing native songs while they're doing that.
No, they don't, Bob. They just take your order, and then they peel the bananas, see? Now, I originally picked out a yellow one with brown speckles. I'd read somewhere that those were the best, but the waiter recommended another one instead that turned almost completely black there. So,
is that the type you'd recommend to our listeners as well?
Well, no. I think the waiter was all wet in choosing that one for me. It was soft and kind of rotten on the inside. So if I had it to do over again, I'd go back to my original choice of yellow with brown speckles.
Well, that sounds like a good tip for all our listeners to remember when they visit the Little Bit of Honduras Bar and Grill in Jersey City. Now I know we both have plans for dining out in the week ahead as we search for more little-known but truly fine restaurants around town.
Welcome again now to the Bob and Ray Public Service feature, Chatting with Dr. Chesney. Now, this is the portion of the show where we invite all of you disturbed listeners to call in and receive some expert advice from the noted psychologist, Dr. Merton Chesney. Say, Doctor, it's good of you to take time from your private practice to be with us today.
I'm interested in your comment that it's good of me to be here. You know, our concepts of good and bad are just personal attitudes that our parents have taught us.
Well, in a general sense, I suppose so. However, I was...
No, there's no doubt about it. So the only question is why your folks taught you that it's good for a psychologist to leave his practice in order to appear on a radio program.
Well, I don't think that specific issue ever came up when I was a child.
You see what happens? We forget how we were taught our moral standards, but we still accept them as fact. Now, close your eyes and search into your subconscious. You're a 2-year-old in your playpen.
No, that's not what I am at all. Now, if you'd be good enough to pick up your phone there, and let's get on with this thing.
Why do you imply that it's good to pick up a phone and bad not
to? I don't know. Just pick it up.
I can see the subject is upsetting you, so I'll let it go for now. Pick up the phone. Hello, you're on the air with Dr. Chesney.
Hello? My name is Stanley W. Proxwelder.
Well, sir, we don't want you to give your full name on the air. We'll have to cut that out.
Okay,
later.
Well, then let's just say I'm an anonymous parent.
All right.
And I'm having discipline problems with my son, Stanley W. Proxwelder Jr.
How old is the boy?
Oh, I guess he's about 8. Maybe still 5. Hey, kid, how old are you?
Your relationship with your son must not be very close if you have
he
to
He says
ask.
He's 12, but I don't know. He's a pathological liar.
Well, that's your chief problem, then, I guess. He tells lies, right?
No, that doesn't bother me much. I hardly ever talk to him. The main problem is how he keeps doing these annoying things just because he knows they bother me.
Well, give
know?
Me an example, could you?
Oh, sure, lots of them. For instance, he always brings home a perfect report card. And I'm sure he does that just because he knows I flunked everything when I was his age. So he likes to give me the needle, you know?
And I suppose you've tried keeping him home from school as punishment.
Yeah, but then he just tries to set the house on fire. That's when I see where a lot of light, though. See, I'm a professional arsonist.
Well, then I'd suggest you and your son build a relationship by pursuing your mutual interests together. Now I have to turn to another caller here. Hello, you're on the air with Dr. Chesney.
Hello, I'm not sure what my problem is, but I know I'm terribly angry.
Well, we mustn't think of anger as being an abnormal condition. It's often an appropriate response, ma'am.
Well, it's certainly appropriate in this case. Ever since your man was out here, I get gas from my water faucet and cold water from the stove, and he charged me $30 just to mess up the pipe.
Now, you have the wrong number, madam. I'm Dr. Merton Chesney, the noted psychologist. And
your man's even put my telephone on the fridge. Now I'm really ticked off.
Well, as I said, that may be an appropriate response. We have time for just one more call, I'm told. All right, you're on the air with Dr. Chesney. Make it fast, please.
Hello? I just heard you tell the first guy not to give his name, and I was awfully glad about that.
Is that because you want to preserve your anonymity, too?
No, it's because I don't remember who I am.
Well, then you're suffering from amnesia. Have you had a blow on the head recently?
Well, how would I remember something like that when I don't even know who I am?
Well, if you had an accident, there might be some evidence around that would help you prove it.
Well, that's true. Hey, Evelyn, have you noticed whether any of my dirty clothes are torn like I'd been in an accident? No, she says not.
Who was that you were just talking to?
My wife.
Why can't she tell you who you are?
Hey, I'll bet maybe she could have done. Gee, I don't know how to thank you, Doc.
No, thanks are necessary. Just knowing I've helped you is enough. And on that note, this is Dr. Merton Chesney wishing you all in Radioland good luck and good emotional stability. And hi there, sports fans. This is your eyes and ears of the press box, Biff Burns, coming your way from Mike's side with another Biff Burns Sports Room guest. Highlights and sidelights from the world of sports, and my special guest today is Roy Yelvington. According to the dope sheet you sent me, you're better known to the fans and your fellow players as Little Lightning.
That's right, Biff. I've been, never too big, but I'm extremely fast. So the name has kind of stuck with me since early in my career. Fans and my fellow players have always called me Little Lightning.
Yeah, you go into all that in this dope sheet you sent me, Roy, but I notice you fail to mention what sport it is you compete in.
I play Ring Around the Rosie, Biff. And I'm in town all this week, beating the drum for the sport and trying to whip up some interest in the New York Fallers.
Well, I assumed you were here to beat the drum and try to whip up interest in something, so just to get the discussion started, what or who are the New York Fallers?
Well, that's the professional Ring Around the Rosie team that will be opening its inaugural season at Shea Stadium next month.
Ah.
See, I'm the player-manager of the squad. I might also mention that season ticket sales have begun at a considerable discount from what you'll have to pay at the box office later on.
Well, even at a considerable discount, Roy, do you think there's really much spectator appeal to a game like Ring Around the Rosie?
Well, Biff, we're planning some big halftime shows featuring drum majorettes from high schools as far away as Rhode Island. We're also going to give the fans a break by selling hot dogs for a quarter.
Well, even with drum majorettes from Rhode Island and cheap hot dogs, do you think there's much spectator appeal to the game, Roy?
Well, five guys from each side take to the field, and we skip around in a circle, see? And then we get to the real highlight of the thing. The players join together in singing, you know, Ring Around the Rosie, a pocket full of posy, ashes, ashes, all fall down. Now, we may have Barbara Streisand record the song so we can play it over the public address system.
Well, Roy, even if you get Barbara to record the song, do you think there's much spectator appeal to the game? That's what I want to get down to.
Well, there'll be a lot of fights among the players, too, Biff. You see, after the guys sing that part about all fall down, then they all fall down. And the last one down loses. But, of course, we'll have plenty of arguments on that point.
Sure.
I think you can look for a Pier 6 brawl in just about every game. That's what we're hoping for.
Having fights get out of control could be entertaining, Roy. But even so, you think there's much spectator appeal to the game?
Did I tell you we're going to sell hot dogs for a quarter?
Yeah. I think you told me just about everything I want to know, except whether you think the game has much spectator appeal.
Well, I'm not sure, Biff. I'm certainly beating the drum for it and trying to whip up some interest, but I think Ring Around the Rosie has got quite a few things going against it. You know, the recent public opinion poll shows that we could have expected bigger crowds for team javelin throwing or Little League skateboard races, among other things.
As bad as that, huh?
Yeah, of course, we're hoping that the drum majorettes and cheap hot dogs and the Barbra Streisand recording will help some, but in this recent poll, only 0.2% of those interviewed said they'd pay to watch grown men play Ring Around the Rosie.
If that's what the poll indicates, then why are you starting up a professional Ring Around the Rosie League, Roy?
Well, tell you the truth, Biff, Ring Around the Rosie was the only sport I was good at when I was a kid, so I figured I'd like to play professionally, you know, and make a lot of money at it.
Uh-huh.
Now all I have to do is find some rich guy to take over the New York franchise before he discovers that nobody will come to the game.
I see. Uh-huh.
I mean, I really get miffed when I read about basketball players signing pro contracts for $2-3 million just because basketball is a popular sport. So I'm hoping to collect a fat bonus myself before this whole promotion of mine falls apart.
Well, now that you've explained your real motive to our vast radio audience, I imagine the whole promotion has already fallen apart. But thanks for stopping by to tell us about it anyway. And now this is Biff Burns saying, until our next get-together in the sports room, this is Biff Burns saying, so long, fans. And so, once again, we've got word that time's up for another Bob and Ray public radio show.
And that word comes from Larry Josephson, who produces the program for the Radio Foundation.
Marjorie Van Halderen was associate producer. Paul Talman provided the music. Technical director, Malcolm Addy.
Sound effects were by Al Schaefer, who's never once regretted giving up a promising career in upholstering.
Our engineers were Mike Moran and Joe Lopes, production assistants Diana Freed and Stuart Zagnett.
Funding for the program by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund.
And now this is Ray Goulding reminding you to write if you get work.
Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your thumbs.
Thank you.
For a free picture of Bob and Ray, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to Bob and Ray Picture, Box 5000, GPO, New York 10116. That's Bob and Ray Picture, Box 5000, GPO, New York 10116.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and or good evening, and welcome to the Bob and Ray Show here on the Bitslap with your host, KBC. I'm only going to break in this once so I can give you an idea of what we're doing here, which you can probably figure it out already. But I wanted to give you a little bit of background on the participants of said show today. So that's what I'll do. You all know Bob and Ray. Bob Elliott, born March 26, 1923, in Winchester, Massachusetts. That's a town about, 15, 20 miles northwest of Boston. Died this past Groundhog Day in Harpswell, Maine. Harpswell, Maine is a town about 120 miles from here, near the town of Bath and Brunswick. And he died on Groundhog's Day, which of course means another 6 to 10 weeks of winter. At least that's the way I always thought of it. He was 92 years old. He would have been 93 in the coming March. Ray Goulding, on the other hand, born in Lowell, Mass., back March 20th of 1922, and died March 24th, a couple of days after his 68th birthday in Manhasset, Long Island, New York. So, but together they've been kind of a staple for, well, they're still with us, that kind of thanks to the miracle of the bit slap. But they've been in the radio business for like 70 years now. Not that they're here, but that's when they started, back about the mid-40s in a Boston radio station called WHDH. Bob was an actual DJ. And Ray was a newsreader, and a lot of times they would have to interact in the same studio, which is where they got their kind of shtick down pat. And during Red Sox games, if there was a rain delay, they would kind of put them together in the same room and see what would happen. And that's where a lot of their stuff came from. They attracted attention, wound up in the big city, meaning New York. And they wound up working for NBC, they worked for CBS, WINS, right next to Murray the K, WOR, and WNEW-AM, and WHN. WHN used to be WMGM back in the old days. I think it's now where the Bloomberg Channel is at 1050 AM. And I remember them from those days, even though I was a young kid and probably didn't get much of what they were talking about. Their routines are just as funny now as they always were, and you could hear something like the Komodo Dragon or the Slow Talkers 100 times, and it still makes you chuckle. And while we won't be hearing from the Slow Talkers, we will be hearing from the Komodo Dragon in a little while. And just wanted to call your attention to the first act out of the box. Back in 1979, they did a thing, Bob and Ray and Jane and Lorraine and Gilda. You remember who those three are, don't you? And you'll be hearing a piece of that, just a small piece, as kind of a way of the history of Bob and Ray. And you'll hear that. And then we're just going to go off in all kinds of different directions. I could be doing this in a week from now, and we would still not touch the same two routines. So I hope you enjoy it. I hope you were always a big fan of Bob and Ray like I was. And what can I tell you? Bob, Ray, we miss you. And we'll see you in that great improv room in the sky. Enjoy.
Good evening, and welcome to Bob and Ray, Jane, Lorraine, and Gilda. I'm Jane.
I'm Lorraine.
And I'm Bob and Ray.
Thank you, Gilda. You know, when we were asked to do this show, I was thrilled, because as a child growing up in Boston, I used to listen to Bob and Ray on the radio.
And I was thrilled because when I was a child in Los Angeles, I had friends who were from Boston who used to listen to Bob and Ray.
And I was thrilled because I grew up in Detroit.
But that's all part of the amazing Bob and Ray story. Bob Finley Elliott was raised by wild groundhogs in the Maine wilderness until he was adopted by his surrogate parents, George and Constance Elliott, who ran a roadside stand near Bath, Maine. Ray Finley Goulding has no memory of where or when he was born, though he believes he's from either Europe or Ohio. His first recollection was being hired on as a child apprentice by inventor Guglielmo Marconi. Marconi was working on something called the radio. And in 1901, Ray's voice was carried on the world's first transatlantic radio signal. On the other end, a young man from Bath, Maine. That's right, Bob Elliott.
Hello.
And that's the fascinating story of Bob and Ray's early years.
But those early years really pale in comparison to the middle years.
Really?
Oh, my, yes. You know, in 1928, Bob and Ray started writing their first comedy routine. And in 1938, they started on their second comedy routine, only to be interrupted by the start of World War II. Bob served his country at home by playing baseball. Most major leaguers had joined the armed forces, leaving critical weaknesses on every team. Bob joined the Boston Red Sox, where he played left field and called the play-by-play.
It's a high fly to left center field. I'm going back. I'm at the warning track. I think I'm hurt. Don't move me.
Because of Ray's physical attributes, he served his country by impersonating FDR. For 3 years, he sat on the White House lawn, tying up Nazi intelligence operatives who stood vigil watching him.
I was really glad when the war ended so I could get up and stretch.
Those middle years sure were exciting, Lorraine, but nothing compared to their most recent years.
Really?
Oh, my, yes.
After the war, Bob and Ray heard about a new medium called television. And this kinescope of Bob and Ray with Audrey Meadows is one of the first TV broadcasts ever seen.
David,
it's only for 2 weeks. Be like a vacation.
Dave, here's the two-way radio set you wanted.
No.
Oh. You do your daily broadcasts over that. What station was it?
The local station here, WMFM and WFMMFM.
Let's try it out and see if it works. I've got the microphone.
The immediate impact of this broadcast was wide-scale panic.
I'll turn it on.
But America grew up and soon could watch almost any television program without panicking, except Dinah Shore. And then came the 60s. The space age, revolution, rock and roll, and, of course, Woodstock. And sure enough, Bob and Ray were there.
We had no idea how big it was until we got there. We thought it was just going to be another Monterey Pop.
After Woodstock, Bob and Ray dropped out of the public eye. Their energies went into marketing of a bold idea. In an idle moment, Bob drew this portrait of Ray. Apparently, it was just what everybody wanted to see. The rest is marketing history. Bob and Ray put their billions into video equipment and built this studio, home of the Finley Quality Network.
Now, round the corner and up your street, comes the friendly poet-philosopher Charles, to reach once again into the pages of his tattered manuscripts, bring forth a poem of nostalgic memory, something for all of us to listen to and to dream by. And here is Charles.
Hello. This poem is called Memory. The rain has turned to tears, and I've been terribly, agonizingly lonely these many years. And I've only had two beers.
Charles, please, please.
The night we kissed and said goodbye, my happiness took wings as if to fly. Make that water with that rye.
Charles, please stick to the poems in your dusty manuscript.
I took your hand in mine, our love to begin. That guilty feeling, that of innocent sin. Add just a dash of gin.
Oh, I'm afraid we can't go on, Charles, this way. Do you want to try once more?
Let me try just once more at the top.
From the beginning.
The rain has turned...
No.
No, I'm afraid we'll have to call a halt to this, Charles. And until the next time he comes round the corner and up your block, Charles, your friendly poet-philosopher, says...
So long now.
Okay, Wally Blue is standing by in Napoleon, Ohio, with a report. Come in, please, Wally Blue.
Lee Blue here in Napoleon, Ohio. At the Great Lakes Paperclip Company, I have been conducting a survey of industrialists who are trying to contribute to the economic health of our nation, and I've come here to speak to the president of the firm, Mr. Hudley Pierce. Thank you for the warm welcome you gave me, Hudley.
Well, thank you. We're always pleased to have visitors here at the plant.
I was amazed to find such a huge factory devoted to the manufacture of such a small item as paperclips.
Well, actually, we're one of the small fellows in the business. There are several companies much bigger than ours in the paperclip business, but we all have the same problems: waste, inefficiency, goofing off, so forth.
Certainly, but you've been doing your best to fight that sort of thing. I was impressed in that one building I saw. I know you have others, but in that one, there was no machinery whatsoever.
No, we don't have any machinery. You see, we buy our wire in long strips, and then our workers cut them in shorter strips, and then bend them by hand into paper clips.
You must have to get a tremendous price for your product if it's handmade like that.
No, we're actually holding the line on cost there. We sell a box of 100 for 10 cents.
Wow.
And here at the factory for 6 cents a box in gross lots.
How many boxes can you turn out in, say, a week's time?
Well, with all three shifts going, we could make 12 boxes. And we can clear about $12.
I mean, you can run a big operation like I've seen here and only take in $12 a week?
Well, we have a low wage structure. You see, here again, we hold the line on costs. Our average worker makes about 14 cents a week.
That is ridiculous. How could anybody possibly live on 14 cents a week?
We don't pry into the personal lives of our employees, Wally. But as I understand it, our people live in caves on the edge of town, and they forage for food.
I noticed... all of your employees seem to be dressed in rags. They have little strips of cloth tied around their feet.
Well, you can't wear shoes when you make 14 cents a week. I guess that's obvious to everybody.
I guess so. That would probably account for a lot of the grumbling I heard while I was over there.
I'm sure it would. Yes, it would.
Still can't understand how anybody can work on a salary like you've described.
Well, there are a few loopholes in our union contract. For instance, there's no mention of wages at all. But there is a provision that makes the worker liable for prosecution and imprisonment if he tries to quit.
I imagine the union will have that changed the first chance it gets, huh?
Well, no, we have what's called a 99-year sweetheart contract. And it has 86 years to run, so we're in pretty good shape.
Well, you've got some time to look ahead, Mr. Pearson. Thanks again for the welcome I got out here. A tip of our hat to you in your fight against all of this waste and corruption.
Thank you very much.
Hudley Pierce, the Great Lakes Paperclip Factory. Thank you, Hudley.
Teedle Soup, the tea that tastes like noodle soup, presents Arthur Sturdley's No Talent Hunt.
Thank you, and hello there.
Hello and welcome to our no talent hunt for tonight. Who's our first scout?
Well, right here we have Stuart Salisbury.
Hello, Stuart. What do you do for a living?
Well, I own a parking lot, and right across the street I have a fender repair shop.
All right, well, now, whom have you brung to us this time?
I got my brother here.
Your brother? Where'd you first discover him?
At the breakfast table one morning about 3 years ago.
That's all right. What does he do, Al Stewart?
He works for me down there at the parking lot. I heard him impersonating one day, and I liked it.
What kind of impersonations does he do?
Birds.
A bird impersonator, huh? Well, let's bring him out here and see how the folks like him. Show me your discovery, Alan Salisbury.
The first bird I'd like to impersonate is a robin.
Chirp, chirp.
The next bird is a crow at 25 feet. Caw,
caw, caw.
Same crow at 50 feet.
Caw, caw, caw.
That same crow 3 miles away.
All right, that was Alan Salisbury, bird impersonator.
Right here, Arthur, is Miss Matilda Proudfoot.
Hello, Miss Proudfoot.
Hello.
Nice to have you here with us. Where's your home?
Little Ossipee, New Hampshire.
Little Ossipee, New Hampshire. That's near Big Ossipee, isn't it?
South of Big Ossipee.
That's up around Sunapee in that way. Whom have you brung to us here today?
Young Clyde Feely.
See on the card here that he is a singer. What kind?
He's a basso profundo.
A basso profundo. Well, let's bring him on out. What's he going to sing for us?
Many brave hearts are asleep in the deep.
All right, Matilda Proudfoot, here he is, Clyde Feely.
Many brave hearts are asleep in the deep. So
tear in my eye when I hear basso like that. And here's our last scout, Fred Phlebas. Fred, welcome.
Thank you, Arthur.
I wish I had time to talk to you, but I don't. Who is your discovery?
Mickey McGaffigan.
Mickey McGaffigan, and what does he do, Fred?
He plays seal horns like a seal. He bites the little rubber bulb at the end with his teeth.
I understand. All right. Well, he's all set up and ready to go, is he?
Yes, sir.
Let's see what the folks think of Mickey McGaffigan. How you pick your winners for tonight. In a brief reprise, first of all, Alan Salisbury, the bird impersonator.
Chip, 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 caw.
Okay, Alan, and now here was our second discovery, Clyde Feely Basso.
Beware.
Okay, and finally we heard from the seal horn player, Mickey McGaffigan. That's enough. We've got a winner, and we find that a winner tonight is... our human...
This is TBS, the Talent Broadcasting System.
We'll have the news and the correct time for you in about 10 minutes. But right now, I'd like to introduce Mr. Square Music himself, Barry Campbell, winner of the award for musical television show. And Barry, it's been nice to have you drop by here today. I want to ask you a few questions about yourself and about the brand of music you turn out.
Well, wonderful, and I want to thank you for the opportunity of coming on your program and letting all your great fans listen to my new album.
Now, this new album is entitled what, Barry?
It's called Barry Campbell Plays for the Debutante Cotillion Dance in Trenton, New Jersey.
And I understand that the entire album was recorded right on the spot. Is that right, Barry?
That's right. and, well, you've probably noticed, being a disc jockey yourself, the great rise in popularity of type of music at balls and dances. It gives it a real huge room sound, and like people dancing, it's
Is
very
that
popular.
So? Well, maybe I that will catch that. On. I hadn't come across that as yet.
Uh-huh.
Do you run into any particular problems when you go on location to make a record? I mean...
Barry, my billing, Mr. Square Music, is an awkward handle for me to cope with.
I should think it would be, yes.
It leads to jibes from dancers as they go by the stand and all, but it's the kind of music I like.
Well, isn't it also, aren't you billed as Barry, Mr. Square Music, Campbell... and his makes you go home humming the melody orchestra?
Well, that's another slogan of mine. You've got to be able to hum the tune.
That's what I thought.
I wouldn't be honest with myself if I played that other type of music, that roll, that rock.
Rock and roll.
Whatever they call it.
You go strictly for the melody so that they can
hum
hear
the
tune and remember it.
That's right. So I wonder if you could put the platter on your turntable now and give it a whirl.
Love to do that for you. Here is Barry, Mr. Square Music Campbell, and his orchestra. Music by Mr. Square Music himself, Barry Campbell, played on location at the Cotillion Ball in Trenton, New Jersey. Barry,
I hope you liked it. And I
heard a great deal of extraneous background noise there. It almost seemed as if there were a fight taking place at one point.
Well, now, everyone
Does that
who's,
bother you when you're up on the stand?
Everyone who's played that record has made the same comment.
Comes through pretty clearly.
Uh-huh. And... You
one fellow didn't even seem to be playing with the orchestra. He seemed to be way out there with the...
I was hoping you wouldn't notice that. He didn't know that it was a take, and it was a little lip practice for the clarinet player. He didn't know that
didn't
we were
know
really
you were
recording.
Really recording it, huh?
I'm sorry you caught that.
Well, I think everybody would catch that.
You do,
yes.
Uh-huh. Well...
Is this already released, or is it too late to bring
no,
it back?
No, they're pressed and out now,
oh, yeah.
And they're at your record store.
Well, lots of luck with it, Barry Campbell, and what are your plans for the future? Do you have other albums that you're
Well, of course, the
make?
Orchestra, you know, is broken up.
It's disbanded, hasn't it?
Well, after we made this one recording at the debutante dance, Cotillion, the bus broke down, and consequently, we went out of business. I couldn't get around.
That was at the beginning of the summer. I remember you were riding an ice cream wagon selling ice cream on the streets.
That's right, right after I disbanded the orchestra.
Did you find a lot of the kids recognized you from your music days? Or?
No, not so much. And my popularity then depended on the weekly special.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the week I had coconut cherry, I think I was most popular.
Well, the burnt almond was pretty good, too, wasn't it?
No, you would think so.
It wasn't popular.
No, it wasn't as popular as I had hoped. Your chocolate chip, I had a nice week with that.
How about the pineapple?
No, there again. Unfortunately, it didn't work out.
I guess vanilla will always be the
Vanilla is,
the big
is
strong...
steady, but then you can never feature it for a week. There's no reason for anybody to stop you when you're featuring vanilla.
Yeah.
Cherry Jubilee, on the other hand, was another flop that I hadn't figured on. So it's been a long, hot summer, and I'm looking forward to a cold winter.
Well, I guess we've covered about everything we can, Barry Campbell. And
well, again, thank you. It's always been not only my favorite program, but my favorite station.
Second home, I imagine.
Right, and I feel like it's my second home, and I've always liked the way you've given the correct time in the news.
Well, we'll be having that time in just a minute or two, and the folks, of course, have all been glad to hear this little chat with you. Your fans are here. I think they kind of consider you a native son in a way, although you weren't born here, were you?
Yes.
Oh, you were. We'll have the news and the correct time for you in about 10 minutes.
You know the Columbia phonograph dealer? You know that one?
No.
Well, he has Columbia first with the LP record, first with guaranteed stereo fidelity records, and now Columbia is first again with Stereo One.
You know what?
I'd call them number one in the wonderful world of sound.
Thank you very much, audience member. You're exactly
now,
right.
Now, can I have some popcorn?
Yes. It's a new listening experience in stereophonic high-fidelity sound that makes all your records, stereo or regular, sound better.
You know, I have in my home four Columbia record players, stereo and otherwise. They're the best.
Four? Ladies?
Four, yeah. Can I have two handfuls of popcorn?
Sure.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, there is a Columbia Stereo 1 phonograph for every room and for every budget, for every listening need. Ray, I think you have the prices there, don't you?
Well, the Columbia Portable... Would you help me hold this up for the audience,
yeah,
Bob? This one, Columbia Portables, priced as low as $24.95. And the consoles with many exclusive new Columbia features start at the amazing low price of $129.95.
Can I buy them on easy terms at my Columbia Phonograph dealer?
Well, I suppose you could talk with him. I think so. But go see him anyway and hear them all real soon.
Well, why don't I take a moment right now for a preview of those fine mystery and adventure dramas that'll be coming our way on CBS Radio this Sunday.
Well, first, of course, there's yours truly, Johnny Dollar, who'll be telling you about a case that involves a beautiful blonde, a shaggy dog, and this will interest you, Muriel, an over-talkative parrot. That's the case Johnny calls the Murdered Mugwump Matter.
Then, suspense brings you the electrifying tale entitled 115 Volts AC and DC, starring the late Captain Marvel.
Also, in the package, you'll find Paladin, whose famous card reads, Have Gun, Will Travel. Sunday, he'll be riding to the aid of a grizzled recluse who promptly puts a slug through him.
Not to mention Gunsmoke, who celebrated U.S. Marshal Day on, will be taking a breather. Next Sunday's Gunsmoke will be devoted entirely to a smooching session between the good marshal and Dodge City Kitty.
All right, now, don't get excited, Chester.
All right, Mr. Dillon.
Now, remember, all four of these top mystery and adventure dramas will be coming your way Sunday on CBS Radio, so be sure to be listening.
You know, I think the program department is pulling our leg. I've heard a lot of synopses in my time, but those sound pretty peculiar to me.
Well, you may have a point there. Guess we'll just have to listen, I reckon.
Yeah.
Come Sunday.
May have a point there, too.
Now, chocolate cookies with white stuff in between them brings you Matt Neffer, Boy Spot Welder.
Matt Neffer, boy spot welding king of the world, and his friend Todd are seated in Matt's apartment right now as the shades of evening draw nigh, and we hear Matt say...
Look here, Todd, this letter in the morning mail from Arizona.
I'm in the den, Matt.
Oh. Come out here a second.
You said something about a letter?
I'm in the den now, Todd, I'm sorry.
Funny, I didn't pass you on the way in.
I went around the other way.
Mm. What letter are you speaking about, Matt?
This letter here that came in the morning mail from
Arizona. This letter written on paper with an envelope postmarked Arizona.
Mm-hmm. I haven't opened it yet because I wanted you to be here when I did.
Mm. Well, what is it inside the...
Out here in the kitchen, Todd.
Oh, yes.
Bring the letter out here. We'll steam it open. Maybe this is something for the FBI.
But why steam it open, Matt, when you don't know what's inside? Well, I mean, if you knew what was inside, there would be some...
I'm not sure that this letter was meant for me.
It's addressed to you.
No,
I mean,
you
your
see
name...
the name.
Why, it says Matthew Neffer.
No. But now, hold it up to the light. What does it say?
Dear sir.
Well, is that me?
There's nothing strange about that, Matt. You're reading the letter inside the envelope. By holding it up to the light, you can read the words on the paper inside. But the letter is addressed to you.
Out here. Out here in the back porch, Todd.
All right.
What the deuce were you saying?
I was saying that you were reading the letter inside the envelope.
Oh, well, then I'll just tear it open and read it.
Wonder who it's from. Do you know anybody in Arizona?
No, but there's a chance that I knew somebody and then they moved to Arizona. There, now, let's see what it says. Well...
Mm-hmm. though the story becomes more interesting every time. Here is a letter from someone Matt does not know of in Arizona. A letter addressed to Matthew Knepper, but which begins, "Dear Sir." What does the letter mean, and what part will it play in Matt Knepper's future life as boy spot welder? Next time, we'll hear Matt say,
"Over here, Todd, by the special delivery window."
In the next episode of Matt Knepper, Boy Spot Welding King of the World.
Right now, it's time for another informative session with Dr. Elmer Stapley, the word wizard. Dr. Stapley, as you know, is one of the nation's outstanding authorities on the meaning and derivation of English words, and he's here to answer questions that you listeners send in about our language and its correct use. You ready to take a fling at the first question, Doctor?
Well, Mr. Elliott, the only accumulation I can make upon the receptionizing of your last sentence is that you are of grammatical ignominies. It should be obviating that one cannot take a fling at a question. The word fling is an untransitive verb and is conjected through its various monogamies as I fling, I flang, I have done flung.
Uh-huh.
Under no circumference could it take the word question as its predication. Do I make myself replete?
Yes, but I don't think we better discuss what you make yourself replete with.
Uh-huh.
I think I know. Let's get right to the mail here.
Sure.
First, from a woman in Manhasset. Ray, that's your hometown, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Bob.
Yeah. She says, "I keep wondering why we refer to a person with a suntan as being brown as a berry. They let me have a small garden out behind the occupational therapy building, and I've tried raising every type of berry I can think of, but most of them turn out to be red or purple, and none have ever been brown. Is the expression wrong, or have I simply misunderstood it?"
Well, she simply misunderstood it. The homony we use to describe a person with a suntan is red as a beet.
Yeah.
Now, this, of course, refers to a police beet and the color of the soles of an officer's feet after he spent 8 hours walking one.
Well, I think that answer set a new all-time record even for you, Doctor.
Right.
It's not only completely inaccurate, didn't even deal with the expression the woman was talking about.
Thank you. I was rather proud of the way I handled the thing myself. Now, what's next?
This letter from a man in Bridgeport. We've had a lot of mail from Bridgeport lately. Haven't we, Ray?
Yes, we have, Bob.
He writes...
Leave me out of it, please. I'm trying to rest.
Just trying to include you in the group kind of thing.
Don't go out of your way, please.
All right. The man writes... Doctor?
Yes?
The man writes, "I make a lot of startling, ridiculous statements, and some of my friends react by saying, gosh."
Uh-huh.
This usually terminates the whole conversation because I don't know what they mean. Now, I tried looking up the word gosh in the dictionary, and just referred me to the phrase, gosh all hemlock,
uh-huh,
which left me even more confused. Can you tell me what just plain gosh means?
Well, it sounds as if it might be a conniption of some longer word. They do a lot of that up in Bridgeport,
you have know. Conniptions, you mean?
Yes, yes. The people there speak with sort of a regional diatribe and tend to slurp their words together. I would assimilate that gosh is a shortened form of either goulash or galoshes.
Well, a gentleman says it comes as a reaction when he makes a startling comment. So I guess either goulash or galoshes would be a logical comeback.
Huh? Really? Well, it doesn't seem that way to me.
No, it doesn't to me either.
No.
Here's one from a lady in Vermont. Good to be getting up that way. She writes, "I'm a notary public."
Oh?
"And in that capacity, I illegally grant American citizenship to a lot of people who sneak into this country from Canada, illegally. Of course, the whole ceremony is a fraud, but even so, I'd like to conduct it properly. Is it more correct to say, I reckon it's how you swear a blue streak to hold up the United States? Or is the proper phrasing, now you done got to pledge abhorrence to the Republicans right where you stand?"
Well, no, under this kind of circumnavigance, I think the best thing to say would be the documents will set you back $10, but nobody will be able to tell them from the real thing.
Yeah, I think putting it that way lends more dignity to
the
occasion, and I'm sure it's enabled our listeners to see how the proper and direct use of our language can avoid misunderstanding. Thanks for these letters, Doctor. Will you be back later to answer a few more?
Well, thank you very much. I found the experience completely repugnant.
Right now, our New York correspondent, Bob Elliott, is covering the literary scene tonight, so come in, Bob.
It seems as if every year they're coming out with bigger and bigger books at higher and higher prices. Now, the author of one such work is here with me now. You are Mr. Nelson, Alfred E. Nelson, am I correct
in
that?
That's right, and the book I wrote is a history
of the United States.
Yes, well, I've been looking through this copy we have here. It's 1,100 pages long, isn't it, Mr. Nelson?
And at that, I'm just beginning to scratch the history of this country.
Well, now, there are quite a few questions I'd like to ask you about it. First of all, as I remember, you had Abraham Lincoln driving to his inauguration in an automobile. Did you check on that at all?
Well, there are several glaring errors in the book that unfortunately I didn't catch. Now, that was one of them. Referring to the father of our country as Nelson Washington. That was another one. You know, actually, I was thinking of my own last name there, you know. Actually, his real name, I think, is George.
Yeah, well, you have a number of things like that in the book here, and I think you had the editor of Poor Richard's Almanac as Benjamin French or something like that.
Yeah, instead of French, it should have been Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah. Well, no, when did all these things come to your attention, these mistakes, these glaring errors?
Well, a friend of mine brought them to my attention. After the book was published, I sent out copies to the reviewers, you know, on various newspapers and TV stations. And then I sent one to my friend. And he no sooner got a hold of it than he called me at home and he started to point out, you know, several little errors that unfortunately got through.
Yeah, well, like on page 820, if I remember, you have the first capital of the United States in Bailey's Mistake, Maine.
Yeah.
What prompted you to do a thing like that?
Well, it was just carelessness on my part.
Do any research at all for this book?
Well, quite a bit, but what happened was that I relied on my memory a great deal.
From what you learned in school?
Yeah, what I learned in school, that's right.
How far did you go in school, by the way?
I went through the eighth grade.
And you wrote an 1,100-page history book with only an eighth-grade education.
Yeah, well, we had a very intensive history course, see?
Yes, but an eighth-grade education isn't enough to qualify a person, even a genius, to write a book of this sort.
Well, that's what you say, you know.
Your book proves it, Mr. Nelson.
Well, look, I had all the facts. It was just that, you know, I had the names wrong. A few dates were wrong.
Right.
For example, I had the Civil War happening in 1911.
Yes.
Which, you know, was wrong, of course, right?
Yeah.
That I could have checked by asking almost anybody on the street. But here again, I was too dogged. You know, when I sit down on my typewriter, I just start and want to get through. You know, just couldn't work.
I understand. Frankly, I think this is a pretty sloppy piece of work.
Yeah, it's a shabby piece of work, and I'm the first to admit
it. It also sells for $47.50, which is a ridiculous price for an 1,100-page thing like this.
Well, look here, it's leather-bound. The publisher, you know, he's fit to be tied with the mistakes.
So. I don't care about the binding anyway. It's the book inside that's important.
Well, the binding does mean something. It's real hand-tool leather, you know. Pages are nice and glossy and everything.
Let me just say that I'm not going to let any of my children see it when they ask me about history.
Well, let me put it this way. I'll never appear in your program again, either.
Okay with me.
That's okay with me.
And that is our book report for this session. Back to Control Central.
Thank you, Bob. We'll be right back after these words.
So have you noticed lately the in-vogue words? Words like, well, I guess they always were in the dictionary, but suddenly you hear them more and more. Words like pejorative, charisma certainly, dichotomy, Susskindisms we call them. We use that in the pejorative sense, of course. And expertise. You hear that all the time. Now, that implies that you're listening to the words of an expert. And that's one thing we have plenty of here today, our experts. We're delighted to have with us the world-renowned Komodo Dragon Authority from Upper Montclair, New Jersey, Dr. Daryl Dexter. Dr. Dexter, would you tell everybody all about the Komodo Dragon, please?
The Komodo Dragon is the world's largest living lizard. It's found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and nearby Rinja, Padaran, Flores. It's a ferocious carnivory, and one swipe of its tail can render an enemy senseless.
Where do they come from?
The Komodo dragon, the world's largest living lizard, is found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo, hence its name. And that is in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and the nearby islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores. We have two in this country, two Komodo dragons, which were given to us some years ago by the late former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno.
I believe I read somewhere where a foreign potentate gave America some Komodo dragons. Is that true?
Yes. The former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno, gifted this country with two Komodo dragons, world's largest living lizards, some years ago. And they're in the National Zoo in Washington.
Well, now, if we wanted to take the children to see a Komodo dragon, where would we take the children to see a Komodo dragon?
If you were in the vicinity of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., you would take the kiddos to the National Zoo. And there you would see two Komodo dragons, the world's largest living lizards. There's a stuffed Komodo dragon in the lobby of the Royal Hotel in Kathmandu, Nepal.
I believe they're of the lizard family, aren't they?
Yes, they're the world's largest living lizard. And they're ferocious carnivory. One swipe of their tail can render an enemy senseless.
I believe we've just about exhausted the subject. I want to thank you very much for coming by. I know it works a great hardship on you to come in here from Upper Montclair, New Jersey.
Yes.
And I want to thank you. Do you have a ride home?
No, I don't.
Well, maybe somebody here in the audience would be kind enough to give you a lift after the show.
That would be very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
As a public service paid for by the National Foundation to Improve Things, we invite you now to spend another educational session with the idol of the nation's youngsters, Mr. Science. And as we look in on the laboratory today, we see that little Jimmy Schwab is just arriving to watch Mr. Science perform his latest fascinating experiment.
Well, hello there, Jimmy. You're right on time to watch me perform my latest fascinating experiment.
Gosh, all hemlock, Mr. Science. What fascinating experiment are you going to perform today?
Well, I'm sure you'll remember from last time we were discussing Archimedes' principle, and I promised to demonstrate it for you.
Holy cow, Mr. Science. I don't remember anything about that at all.
Well, that's all right, Jimmy.
The doctors have told my parents that I'll probably never be able to remember anything for as long as a week.
Well, Archimedes' principle only takes a moment to review. It states that a body immersed in water will only sink until it has displaced the amount of liquid that's equal to its own mass and density. Now, do you understand, Jimmy?
Gee, willikers, I don't think so. And even if I do, I can't remember it for a week.
Well, I'm sure after you've observed today's experiment, it'll be fixed more firmly in your mind. Now, to prove Archimedes' principle, we first must fill this bucket with liquid.
Criminently, Mr. Science, that liquid looks exactly like the stuff we get in our bathtub at home when we turn on the faucet.
Well, that's just could be, Jimmy, because the bucket now contains ordinary household water.
Household water? Great day in the morning. Wait till I tell the kids at school I've seen some of that.
Now, let's try to keep yourself under control, son. I know this is a big thrill for you, but the best part is still to come. Now, I'm going to toss this rock into the bucket of water, and you watch carefully what happens.
Holy Moses, Mr. Science, it went clear to the bottom underneath all the liquid.
Exactly. And do you know why?
Golly, no. I never expected that to happen.
Well, just remember what we said about Archimedes' principle. You see, the rock was heavier than the water, and that's why it sank in an effort to displace its own mass and density.
Great suffering catfish. It's like the wonders of the universe were unfolding before my very eyes.
Well, that's very well put, Jimmy. Now, to complete our experiment, I'll place this wooden toothpick in the same bucket of water.
Boy, oh boy, look at that. It's not sinking in an effort to displace its own mass and density. So Archimedes was wrong, huh?
No, not at all, Jimmy. You see, wood is lighter than water.
Even a whole tree full of it?
Yes, in proportion to its size. That's why wood always floats. And it's our way of proving by a simple experiment here in the laboratory that Archimedes' principle is correct.
Jiminy, gee, that was a wonderful experiment, Mr. Science. Can I toss this box into the bucket and see if it floats,
too?
No,
leave that alone. It contains the ingredients for next week's experiment. Don't touch it, boy.
Well, I only want to toss it in like this.
No, I'd rather
you
do it.
Answers to Science has been brought to you as a public service, paid for by the National Foundation to Improve Things. Today's broadcast was the last in our current series.
Well, we thought it might be nice right now. Is that light blinking on the phone there?
Yeah.
This could be important. Hello?
Hello, Bob?
This is Bob.
Hey, Ray, how are you, fella? This is Steve
Bob.
Bosco.
Steve.
Hey, Ray, hope you have a good and happy new year
Steve
for yourself. Put on, Bob, will you, Ray boy?
This is Bob, Steve. Wait a minute. It's
Hey,
Steve.
Bob, Steve.
Right.
Happy new year.
Happy new year to you.
Hey, what do you think of all those ball games?
Oh, they were real good.
How you doing, fella?
Hey,
did you have a happy new year?
Yes, wonderful, Steve.
Hey, that's
Haven't
hey,
heard from you for several weeks now.
Hey, Bob.
Yes?
Happy new year, fella.
Yes.
Hey, look, Bob.
Yes.
Steve here.
Right.
Hey, look, I need some money.
Well, now, wait.
I want to head down to Clearwater, Florida, take a look at some of the baseball teams,
Well, one
Bob.
Thing, now, the spring training doesn't start for a couple of months yet, at least, and this is kind of early to be going down there, don't you think?
How you doing? Hey, did you have a happy new year?
Yeah, well, real
hey,
nice.
Hey, good, Bob. Say happy new year to Ray.
Listen, we haven't had any reports from you for months
Bob,
now.
Bob, this is Steve.
Right,
hey,
I know.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, look, I need some money. I want to go down and cover the spring training of the baseball team.
Well,
I want to go to Clearwater.
Will you make sure you'll call us and give us reports if
yeah.
we send it?
How you going, Bob? I hear you all the time, every
okay.
afternoon and mornings.
Wonderful.
Nights. I listen to you. Hey.
Yes.
Happy New Year, Bob.
The same to you, and we'll get the money off if we can be promised a report for next week.
Hey, would you send about $600, Bob?
Where'll I send it?
To the most expensive hotel in Clearwater. And now, this is Steve Bosco rounding third, being thrown out at home.
Here now are Webley Webster and Wally Ballou with the Bob and Ray editorial of the air for this week.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much.
It's time to look the issues squarely in the face.
The problem concerns all of us. If it continues to be ignored, the dismissal of what is now a routine matter may result in its becoming even more grave as time, valuable time, goes by.
Hindsight, it was once noted, is an admirable means of settling affairs that have grown too big to be disposed of at the time of conflict.
Yeah, but this is an issue that must be dealt with now, for history is the ledger of time. And what we have here is a notation in the ledger of history. Let there be no mistake about that.
Now, most of us have shown a willingness to stand up for the things we want, the things we hold so close to us. We've not wavered, nor have we sidestepped problems that seemed at the time to have no resolution.
Instead, bold, imaginative strides forward were taken. This is what we are used to, the habit of success.
Though it was much of a shock to us, as it probably was, good listeners, to you, when we heard opposition voices being raised.
Why the belated outcry?
Why indeed, dear listener? Why do they oppose us now?
Why do they choose this particular time to make themselves heard?
And why, we must ask ourselves, at this moment in our affairs, do they want this issue tabled?
We cannot agree with what Rachel
was
saying about
to Webley Webster and Wally Ballou with this week's Bob and Ray editorial of the air. And we'll be back with a spooky sound in just 10 seconds.
Doubled under.
Now here's the picture all America has been waiting for.
Now at last it can be told.
Now for the first time someone dares tell this different story. You'll be shocked.
You'll be thrilled.
You'll laugh.
You'll cry.
You'll wish you stayed home.
When you see Repulsive Pictures' greatest triumph.
Grub, the story of food.
It took 5 years to film this moving spectacle. Imagine the stark realism of tons of roast beef consumed by 5,000 extras.
See 1,500 screaming babies waiting for their strained spinach.
See tons and tons of frozen food. Women fought for.
Men died for.
Grub.
Grub stars Sherman L. Sturdley as fearless Figlioni.
Marcia Van Allshot as luscious Lucretia.
Plus Jonas Lattimore as the kindly old grocer. And introduces Barry Campbell as Figlioni's son, Mario, who'll sing his way into your heart.
Can't you hear me calling Caroline?
Now listen to an unforgettable scene from the picture Grub.
Figlioni has just been refused admittance to the cafeteria by Lucretia.
You mean I won't have my grub today?
I'm sorry, Figlioni. If it were anyone but you.
But you've always given me my grub, Lucretia.
How about today, Figlioni? You have no ticket. If you were to be challenged in the grub line and you had no ticket, it would mean instant death.
But, Lucretia, you don't understand. I must have my grub.
Yes, scenes such as this are many in Repulsive Pictures' latest release.
Filmed in various shades of gray, be sure and see Grub, the story of food.
Produced by the same studio which gave you the moving vehicle, Crosstown Bus.
See Grub, the story of food, opening soon at your neighborhood theater.
Hello, it's time to pay another of our regular visits to the Bob and Ray Hobby Hut, a special feature conducted by Neil Plummer, editor of Wasting Time magazine. Neil is nationally known as Mr. Hobby himself, and I see he's getting set up over at our other microphone with his special guest for today. So we'll just let you pick it up from there and carry on, Neil.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. I think the gentleman here beside me has a collection that will be the envy of every hobbyist. His name is Carl Dickert. Of course, that immediately rings a bell with all your listeners who collect odd-shaped fruit and vegetables. But for the benefit of the non-hobbyist, I wonder if you'd tell us something about your collection, Carl.
Yes, I'd be happy to, Neil. My collection consists of odd-shaped fruit and vegetables, and I've traveled all over the country to assemble the prize pieces I brought with me today. I'm always reading in the paper about somebody who's grown a Hubbard squash in the shape of an elephant or something like that. So I usually hop the next plane to go dicker with the owner about buying it for my collection.
And I assume you keep the specimens in these paper sacks that you brought with you.
Yes. There aren't any ready-made albums available for displaying strange items of produce. And buying plane tickets to travel around the country, picking up the stuff, takes a lot of money.
Sure.
So I cut corners by keeping the collection in 238 separate paper sacks. I brought about 20 of the best ones with me today.
Well, it's too bad that there aren't any albums available for what you collect, Carl.
There aren't.
But I see that you have labels neatly pasted on each sack telling what's inside. And where you got it.
Yes, I try to put all that information down while I still remember pertinent details. Like this one here, you can see it identifies the contents of the paper sack as a cluster of 5 carrots, all grown from a single seed and attached to each other at the top. I obtained those in August of 1974 from an elderly gentleman in Minnesota. And here at the bottom it lists the price I paid, $3.25.
Well, that's certainly cheap enough for an unusual specimen like 5 carrots all attached to each other.
Yes, the old man needed money, so he let them go cheap. But, of course, my transportation to Minneapolis from my home in Florida ran almost $400, so I have more invested than you might think.
Yes, I'm sure you do. And I notice another sack here that's labeled cantaloupe in the shape of a dill pickle. Well, now, that's hard to imagine. I wonder if you could remove some of your prized specimens like that from their sacks so we could, you know, describe them for our listeners.
You mean you want me to open the sacks?
Yes, if you don't mind. I don't see you have a strip of tape across the top of each one holding it shut, so it shouldn't be too hard to put them back after we've seen them.
No, it won't be hard, so if you're sure that's what you want, okay.
Oh, phew. Oh, boy, that smells terrible.
Yes, I know. Boy. That's why I couldn't figure out why you wanted me to open the sacks. Some of this fresh produce is 4 or 5 years old.
Oh,
see, the date on this cantaloupe in the shape of a dill pickle is September 14th, 1972.
Get it away from me. I don't want to see the date. That stench is really overpowering.
What? Yes, that's why I keep the specimens in sacks with the tape across the top that way.
Oh, boy.
Doesn't seem to be any way to preserve odd-shaped fruit and vegetables, so they keep their odd shape.
Well, you know, all you've got there is garbage, actually.
I suppose you could say that, Neil. But, of course, I can visualize what each item looked like when it was still fresh. That's why I always take a plane to go and pick up the stuff, so I can see it at least once before it decays. I'll take this one here. It's a tomato that grew up in the shape of a chicken.
Oh, boy, that's awful. Oh, hey, that smells worse than the first one.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
3-year-old tomato that's not refrigerated will tend to do that.
Oh, hey, would you close those sacks and seal them up again, please?
I thought you said you wanted to see the stuff.
I changed my mind now. Will you get all that stuff out of here? Oh, boy, yes. What a stench.
Yes, I guess it's really not the kind of a collection I should put on display.
Oh, boy.
So I'll just take it and leave. Goodbye.
Well, that seems to close out another of our informative sessions here in the Hobby Hut. So until next time, this is Neil Clemmer, urging all of you to have a good day and find a good hobby.